The Guardian.
Thanks for downloading this Guardian podcast, brought to you in association with Squarespace. For all you need to build beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. Although Labour held on to Stoke, a significant loss in Copeland has raised questions about whether the party can convince what was once its core vote. As it tries to face in all directions on Brexit, polls show that Labour is headed for disaster unless things change. So what could it do to reconnect? I spoke to the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, about his party's challenge.
People won't vote for a divided party, so we have to unite, but also we need to make sure we're developing together in common programmes and policies that people support and that resonate with their daily lives.
Joining me in the studio are Guardian columnist and Momentum member Paul Mason, Richard Angel of the Labour pressure group Progress, and the Guardian columnist Zoe Williams. Welcome to you all. But first, I've been speaking to the Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell ahead of next week's budget, and with billions of pounds still missing from the Exchequer due to tax avoidance, he's pushing a new idea about how to tackle the tax gap.
Some years ago, people have been campaigning for more openness and transparency in our taxation system, and one of the ways of doing that is making sure people publish their tax information. This is done in Sweden, Finland, Norway. In those countries, it's been done for a century. Everyone publishes their income tax returns. I'm suggesting, because there's such a lack of confidence and trust in our establishment, maybe we should have millionaires, set it at millionaires, to publish their income tax returns. In that way, it would help us on tackling tax evasion, tax avoidance, but also I think it would help us in restoring trust, both in terms of how our country is run, but also in our taxation system. I publish mine every year. Nothing to hide in that sense, because I have a responsibility as Shadow Chancellor for determining, hopefully, in due course, the policies of our taxation system. So I think that's normal.
And next week, what will you be focusing on in the budget? What do you want to see?
The government, given the current economic situation, although there are some concerns about the decline in consumer spending, which has buoyed up the economy since the Brexit vote, and we're seeing the first signs of lack of business investment in the longer term, nevertheless, the government still has income coming in, which it could help in terms of halting the crisis in our public services. We can't go on now and see patients being treated on trolleys, public services being in decline, social care in crisis. We think the government has got about £12 billion to use. We think that should be invested in social care and the NHS. And in the government, most of it, I think, needs to be, because it's in such a crisis. And in that way, we can reassure people that they've got a service that they can rely upon. But people are really worried now.
And last question, you've obviously had one difficult by-election result, one more positive by-election result, and you've told us that you think it's now time to step away from the cliff edge and for the party to unite. Will you be talking to other groups like Progress through the budget, trying to bring together ideas?
I was in Copeland. Stoke was a victory for us, and it was a tremendous victory in terms of making sure the UKIP didn't get a seat, and I think we've set UKIP on a trajectory, I think, which will result in the decline of UKIP, thank goodness. But in Copeland, we looked over the cliff edge, and to be frank, didn't like the future that we saw. And I think now is the time to pull back, unite the party, start talking to each other, listening and learning from one another. And that means, from my perspective, I'm on the left of the party, that means talking to the centre and others. So that means people like Progress. Liam Burnham has done some great work in terms of analysis of what's happened to Labour over the last couple of decades. John Crudder's the same. We want to bring all those people together and start talking now about our way forward. But people won't vote for a divided party, so we have to unite. But also we need to make sure we're developing together in common programmes and policies that people support and that resonate with their daily lives.
And is Progress and everyone else up for it?
Certainly think so. Certainly there'll be an open door from my point of view. Well, more than that, actually. I've offered to go and see them and speak at conferences and meetings and things like that. But more importantly, not just speak at them, sit down and listen to people.
Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell there, and listening to that is Richard Angel. So, Richard, an open door to Progress. Are you willing to let John McDonnell walk through that door, start conversations, and try to move the Labour Party past where it is now?
I think we're always keen to work with fellow people in the Labour Party about the problems that face our party, and the problems are huge. You know, we've lost a Labour-held seat in the last week when the Tories were closing down a maternity unit and an urgent care centre. This is a critical time for the party. So, of course, we're keen to talk with people. But John McDonnell doesn't always play nicely. This is somebody who went on the telly and said Progress members were Tories and members of the hard right, which is a term we reserve for fascists, really. It's not a very pleasant way that he talks about friends and colleagues. He's made up this spurious nonsense about the soft coup taking place to try and give this sense that they're under siege so they can get back to this internal strife that they seem to enjoy in the party.
You say that, but isn't there something in the idea of a soft coup? It's not like the MPs who, you know, triggered a leadership election after just 9 months of Jeremy being in charge. They really wanted to get rid of him. It's not like they're now loving the leadership. Behind the scenes, they still want to remove him, don't they?
They're not loving the leadership, but they're letting him have a chance to put his message out to the country, and it turns out it's found wanting. He's got little to say on policy issues. The sloganeering's come to an end. The staff are falling apart and leaving on a regular basis. And his own supporters, like Owen Jones, are coming out saying this project is doomed.
Paul, Copeland, a lot of Corbyn supporters try and stress that it was a marginal seat. Look, however you look at this, that is not a good result.
Well, marginal seats are what you need to win an election. So that's, even though it is a marginal seat, it's a very serious thing not to win it, because it means it's going to be very difficult to win as we currently are configured. Now, I think what people on whatever you want to call yourself, the Labour right, need to decide is, do they want a Labour government? And if they do, they need to stop the sabotage. They need to stop. One thing is, they need to stop walking away from Parliament one by one. And they need to decide if they want a Labour government with Corbyn as leader, with them taking their rightful role as policy formers, as MPs, as councillors. What are we all going to do? How are we all going to come to an institutional and political arrangement that makes us all, if not happy, but gives us something we can live with? Because my interpretation of Copeland is, and I'm not surprised sort of fair weather friends are falling off the cart at the moment, because it's perfectly clear that if you have a left-wing Labour leader and you actually embody some left-wing Labour policies, like a half-trillion fiscal stimulus, then, of course, it becomes difficult to win the centre. My argument has always been, we will convince the centre through our radicalism, not through saying, hey, by the way, guys, we're the same Labour as we always were.
And Zoe, your politics probably not that far from Paul's, is that fair to say? You want a radical left?
Absolutely, I agree with Paul that I'm kind of not interested in the electoral compromises that the centre of the party seem to think. The kind of approach seems to be very functional. You know, it's like these, but you know, we need to win these people. What do we need to say to win over those people? How are those people being won over by those other people? It's like a kind of seduction without any intention of actually. Without any love.
So what love do you want to see?
Well, I kind of want to see a party that really believes in its own project. And I think the problem I have with the Corbyn show is that, you know, I supported his leadership. I thought he did have ambition and he did have discontinuity with the party as was. And he was radical enough. You know, there's one thing to say about Jeremy Corbyn is that he's never been frightened to say an unpopular thing. But what I found wanting in the project is, firstly, I don't think that project is very radical.
You're not radical enough, Paul.
Well, we're talking about Corbyn. I'm not a member of the Corbyn team.
But you're a supporter.
I'm a supporter. And I think there are... the problem is not whether or not the actual policies are radical. The problem is that Brexit is framing everything. And the other thing we must remember is that, as well as Brexit, Scottish nationalism and the provoked English nationalism that is the response to it also frames everything. So we have to answer questions like, will you go into a coalition with the SNP? We have to answer things like, what does Brexit mean for me? And I think one of the weaknesses that the Corbyn, as it were, wider movement has inherited from Labour leftism of old is the belief that you just win on economic issues. You talk about the NHS, the automatic assumption is that people go, oh, Labour, they support the NHS. I'm having more and more conversations with ordinary people where I say, isn't the NHS terrible? And I'm afraid what comes back is, yeah, because of the foreigners. And we can't assume the words NHS automatically resonate the same way as they have for the last 20 years.
And clearly the words NHS didn't resonate enough in Copeland, Richard. As a member of a group which we won't call hard right, we'll call centrist, Progress, what are you doing practically now? And if you were to provide a bit more support to the leadership, what might that look like?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we recognise that we've lost two internal elections, and to people who aren't very good, in my opinion. So that means that's a pretty damning indictment of the position we're in. And we're trying to go through an intellectual exercise to rediscover the country as it is, not just a picture taken in 97 with our great achievements written on top, but take a fresh look at the public. But to Paul, you say about we've got to have a accommodation in the party. You can't even be nice about Owen Jones. You call him a fair weather friend when he speaks
call
truth.
Owen a fair weather friend.
When you're clearly referring to him. This doesn't suggest an idea that this is going to be, you want to work with people. The leadership, if they want to be in government, could do some really simple things. Rule out deselecting MPs in that aggressive act. Why not? Why?
I want them to rule it in, to be honest.
Zoe?
You want to find an accommodation. So you can't possibly mean the things that you've been saying.
I think there's a problem here where we're talking about placable MPs ranged against each other. And actually, really, the problem is most MPs are very, very demoralised. You know, MPs on the left are very demoralised, MPs on the right are very demoralised. But there's a sort of exhaustion about it, which I think, and we commentate on it as though it's like a clash of the titans. And actually, it looks much more like a kind of exhausted 20-year marriage. You know, I really think we need to start being a little kinder to one another, because I don't believe that people are plotting for violence against one another. I think there's just a kind of sense that there are so many things you have to sign up to. None of them carry very much hope or enthusiasm or ambition. I simply don't accept it. Paul calling Owen a fair weather friend, whether or not he was talking directly about Owen, is not a systemic problem about the Labour Party. That is one columnist talking about another columnist. And somehow we expect unity within on the left that we would never expect from the right. You know, we're absolutely fine with Toby Young slating Daniel Finkelstein. We ask ourselves for this kind of purity and singular purpose, which I do not think is possible. I think we need to get more pluralist and a bit kinder.
But isn't the problem, ultimately, that, Paul, you don't want to be in a party in which Richard's allies are in charge, and Richard, you don't want to be in a party in which Paul's allies are in charge. So how do we get past that, Paul?
I've spent the last month...
I think I should be in charge.
Lots of love. Yeah. Bring the love, Zoe.
I've spent the last month talking to Social Democrats in other countries. So Berlin, Stockholm this week, and before that, Sydney. In each of these places, what you might call a traditional Social Democratic Party has to work with either or both a left party of some significance and a significant Green Party. And they all get on fine, even in government. The Berlin city government is a red-red-green coalition. We need to turn Labour into a red-red coalition, I think.
And is that separate parties?
No, it means institutionalising our influence. I mean, you've been, the centre and right have been winning a lot of GC elections and delegate. I didn't even get delegated to my own GC. So, you know, that's great. That's democracy. But let's institutionalise what that means. And I think I would almost say let's have negotiations between leaderships of factions. Even Syriza, you know, the far left party that runs Greece, worked best when it did that, when it actually institutionalised the argument.
Come on, people hate the Westminster bubble. The idea that what we need to do is create another internal bubble of which a group, which quite frankly will almost all be men, will sit and negotiate out the spoils of the Labour Party.
I'm quite happy to have some women negotiating.
Of course, I'm very happy to do it. But this is ridiculous. You know, I worked for the Australian Labour Party and love them as I do. The idea that their riven factionalism was formally embedded in the party as the way forward is ridiculous. It's got to be about the vote. Not about factions.
Zoe?
The suggestion I would make is that most of the ideas that I see which are important and going to be telling in the long run, it would be impossible to pin left or right on them. So, you know, when you talk about automation and a basic citizen's income and of kind of buy-in welfare, kind of all these ideas which will be made necessary by the near future, I wouldn't be able to tell you whether they were left or right because they're new and they can't be placed. Similarly with housing, when you actually talk about what to do about the housing situation, most of the ideas that you'd come up with that would actually work, you couldn't situate on a scale of left to right simply because neither left nor right has done anything for so long. So actually, if we really started to talk about the ideas that divided us rather than the how far left or right we were, I just think we'd get somewhere so much faster.
Richard, a couple of things here. First of all, you think that that isn't the answer. So what do you think is the answer? And can you just tell me, as briefly as you can, what it is that Jeremy Corbyn has done and is doing wrong?
So it's got to be about the voters, and it's got to start with an approach that puts them first. I don't believe that they should we should pander to them about their issues, but I think that they are the starting point for the journey that we have to go on. I think in marginal seats across the country, there are five broad questions they ask. Will you be able to afford to pay my mortgage under if you're in charge? Will there be a good school for people to go to? Will the NHS be there if me or my elderly parents need it? Will, if I'm a victim of crime, will the police be able to turn up and have a chance of catching the person who did it? And have we got an offer for the next generation? And if we're honest, in 2010 and 2015, we didn't bother answering lots of those questions. We've got to get back to that hard politics of doing that.
Well, look, the fact is that none of these questions can be answered if we're going to just accept a kind of the trilemma of a shrinking state and increased globalization and democracy kind of watered down. None of those questions can be answered. No political party can stand up and say, I can guarantee you a brilliant NHS into the next decade, unless they can also tell you what that next decade is going to look like and what kind of diseases people are going to have and what kind of money is going to be coming in and what kind of work they're going to be doing. So you can't just answer the questions of the 1950s with a more confident air. You actually have to do some planning for the future.
That wasn't at all what I was saying, to be fair. I was saying that we should take those into the next decade. That was what we've got to look forward to do. But when it comes to it, we've got to have...
That, right?
Well, of course we are. That's why we keep losing. But I'm
trying... the reason we're failing to do it is because our focus is very narrow. It's like, voters care about their mortgage and their NHS. We'll promise them a low mortgage and a brilliant NHS. This is just not cutting through, as they say.
Okay, Richard?
Equally, that wasn't what I was suggesting. But Anushka asked where the problems are with the party at the moment. I mean, the simple fact is that the leader has to do things to reach out for people to unite behind them. We've seen little attempt by the leadership to do that. On their own terms, the policies, they seem to have lots of them in a leadership campaign, but they can't turn any of them into policies for the country and the party now going forward. And the simple fact is those policies that have broken through with the public, like getting rid of civil nuclear energy, went down very terribly in Copeland because the voters knew that what the hard left were offering them in the current Labour leadership was an end of their jobs, their dignity, and no opportunity to replace them. It doesn't matter what investment you put in, West Cumbria is not going to get a replacement for Sellafield.
Paul, you've talked about how we need to have a coalition, that we all need to work together. But in the middle of all that, you said we should start deselecting MPs. You're also quite interested in changing the leadership rules so that you can guarantee that somebody from your faction in the party stays in control.
Well, let's call it a group. Okay, it's not. I can't guarantee it either because there'll be an election. But what I want is a democratic election. When and if Corbyn decides to hang up his spurs, that election would be democratic and we can't have a left candidate blocked by the majority of MPs. In fact, I think to the soft coup that quite clearly is happening out there, I would say, earth to coup. If you really wanted to get rid of Corbyn, let that rule change pass, because then people who are critical of Corbyn but have supported him in the past could feel confident that there would be a democratic election. But let me just
say, you're only supporting Corbyn because you don't think there'd be a left successor on
no that. I absolutely support Corbyn now and until 2020, because I think he's the right person to do what I'm about to say, which is lead us through a crisis. Because we're having this discussion as if Brexit wasn't taking place. Brexit, actually, those centrist voters you describe, I think, are most upset and obsessed with Brexit's going to ruin their lives. Now, we have to be able to answer what kind of Brexit we can offer them. We have to save Britain from the catastrophe that Theresa May is about to inflict on it. And I think we will be a party that answers a crisis. And that's, I think, where the legitimate difference between our two, me and you, Richard, is that I believe we're in, neoliberalism is collapsing. Blairism tied itself to neoliberalism. We need a complete alternative. And that alternative is going to be radical.
Where is it? You've had the leadership. You've got £5 million of short money to do all the policy work you like, and nothing is coming out. John McDonnell's only idea is to publish the tax returns of people who do their tax returns. The tax avoiders are the people who don't.
Well, John McDonnell has also been going around the country doing economic forums, talking about decarbonisation. Zoe, he said to us in an interview this week, no one's listening to our policies because all they care about is the infighting. Do you think that is a fair charge of MPs and of the media?
I don't think anybody's coming out of this well, if that's what you mean. I think the problem with the policies is that they often don't sound very considered. They're often got that, you know, they often sound a bit garbled. They've gone back on halfway through. They don't really seem very narrow. There's a huge amount of concentration on taxing and making sure pay ratios are right. And these are kind of very soft IPPR-y ideas, just given a bit of old Labour spin,
and
as far as I can make out.
Can I ask you about the debate we were just having about rules for the leadership? So under the amendment that Paul would like to see put in place, you'd massively reduce the number of MPs who you would need to back you in order to be on the ballot for the Labour leadership. I mean, at the moment, they've only needed 35 or perhaps 50, including the MEPs. Do you think that's reasonable to expect that amount of support?
Yeah, I completely agree with Paul, to be honest. If the PLP is so much at odds with the membership that they can only get their own candidate by blocking the membership, then this party isn't salvageable, and they need to have two separate parties.
The reality is, if you can lead the Labour Party when you can only get a dinner party of friends to get you on the ballot, it's such a small group that you're an irrelevant, you're not a contender for Prime Minister. The leader of the Labour Party isn't just there to speak truth to power in Parliament, it is there to seek to replace the Tories on the Treasury green benches, and the only way you do that is if you have a parliamentary majority.
Zoe?
Oh no, but Richard, listen, I've got a huge amount of sympathy with what you're saying. I do not think Corbyn is lodging a proper defence against the catastrophe we're going into, and I'm really worried about it, and I think our opposition should be much, much better. I have so much sympathy with what you're saying, but when you say you can only get a dinner party of friends can get you onto the ballot, a dinner party of friends plus 600,000 members, your worldview relies on the PLP members being inherently more valuable as thinkers and people than the Labour members.
Zoe, they were voted for by 9 million people or whatever it is. Doesn't that mean that MPs have some sort of exaggerated influence? It's not like they are comparable in any way to the membership when it comes to the final result.
Well, I think if you're going to have a membership party I just think there's a question to answer about why we need to do this in order for one group to triumph over the other. If the membership and the PLP are so much at odds that they literally have to change technicalities to triumph and rather than actually persuade one another.
Well, they're not the ones changing the technicalities. They're the ones who are trying to stop the technicalities being changed.
Yeah, of course. But you see what I mean. You know, it's like the PLP should be able to persuade the members of their case, or the members should be able to persuade the PLP what they want. They should be able to talk to each other.
Okay.
They shouldn't have to do it like this.
We're just about to run out of time. I'm going to give you a quick fire, each of you, very quick. Zoe, do you think the members can be persuaded that a new leader is needed?
Yeah, I do. I think they could be persuaded tomorrow.
Paul, are you ready to work with the other parts of the party?
Absolutely, of course, but around what? You know, are we going to replace neoliberalism or are we going to reinflict it on the British working class? That's the question.
Richard, when are you going to be meeting with John McDonnell?
As soon as he gets in touch, I'm sure it'll be forthcoming.
Fantastic. Thank you all very much. Thanks to Richard Angel, Paul Mason and Zoe Williams. Well, earlier, John McDonnell mentioned the budget, and Labour's Shadow Equalities Minister, Sarah Champion, has begun an inquiry into how the economy can work better for women and minorities. She told me what was at stake.
I know that there's a big north-south divide in terms of job opportunities, in terms of aspirations, in terms of opportunities. I know that BAME women, for example, are not able to reach their potential because of discrimination in the workplace. So what exactly can we do to change those real structural issues, blocks, and also how can we make our society more... Well, I suppose more tolerant, more less discriminatory, more open to difference and less threatened by it.
And next week we've got the budget, and there's been a fair amount of talk about the idea that budget measures disproportionately hit women. Do you have evidence of that?
Oh, loads. I mean, I'm big on karma, and Budget Day is falling on International Women's Day. If ever there was a sign that we need to do something, yeah, we've been working for years now with the House of Commons Library to actually do a gender audit on the budget and how it disproportionately affects groups. And what we've found is, year on year, women are coming off worse, where the governments are trying to make gains by, you know, cutting tax credits, for example, or benefits. It's always women that hit it hardest. And what we've found is, in the last autumn statement, of those Treasury gains, 86% of them disproportionately affected women. I mean, that's just not fair. For one thing, you know, women are working, women are contributing to the economy, so why is it that we're not giving them the support that we would give to men?
So what would you do differently in terms of budget measures?
You start at the very beginning. I mean, I would actually start in the womb. Why is it when you're born there is an expectation about what job you can and can't do? Why is it there's an expectation about how much you can and can't earn? So that's a long-term strategy. Short-term strategy, what Labour's going to do is, all of the policies that we're bringing forward, we're going to be gender-proofing them. So what we'll do is, we'll actually do an audit and see if accidentally one group is unfairly discriminated against. That's what the government should be doing now. In the Equalities Act, it is very clear that all public sector has to make sure that they are not discriminating against certain groups because of the policies that are bringing forward. The government have refused to do that. They've refused to do that to the Women's and Equality Select Committee, who have consistently asked for a Treasury member to come and say, why is it that their budgets are adversely affecting women? They don't turn up. They've refused to answer questions. So it's not just Labour calling for this. It's a cross-party group of MPs calling for it.
And can you give me any examples of budget measures that Labour would do that you believe would benefit women?
Well, one of the things which is the easiest win is, rather than just looking at industrial investment in terms of building roads, looking at investment in terms of social investment. So that's investing in the NHS, that's investing in healthcare. It's looking at how we, it's accountancy stuff, it's how we attribute expenditure. So for example, I would be looking at investment in expenditure not just being about roads, but being about teachers' salaries. So they are investing in the long-term skills which helps our economy grow. So it's more about where the emphasis is going. It's not about having more money, or it's not about favouring one group over another. It's just about trying to look at the bigger picture and why certain groups are being discriminated against.
And just explain to me why roads are a bit more men and health service and schools are more female.
I'll give you a very concrete example. Literally. So when you are building a school, what the Treasury would do is, the salaries of the construction workers, they will look as infrastructure investment. The salaries of the teachers who are training the children to become the next generation of employees, they will be looking at that as current expenditure. So it's a different budget heading, but what we need to be doing is looking at how long-term we invest in our economy to enable it to grow. And supporting things like care workers, the NHS, schools, is a really good way of doing that. So that's the sort of thing we're looking at.
And are the workers in those fields disproportionately female?
They are disproportionately female. If you then step back again, if you look at the gender pay gap, which is stubbornly stuck at 18%, the reasons for that is not, I don't think, that people are discriminating directly. It's because our policies discriminate against people. So, for example, a lot more women are part-time workers than men, and a lot more part-time work is not long-term, it's on zero-hour contracts, it's not paid as well as the full-time equivalent. So it's looking at those sort of things. It's trying to be, I suppose, more creative, which is not usually a word associated with economics, but it's sort of taking the bigger picture and seeing how we, on a very practical level, can make the biggest difference.
And just a political question, slightly different issue. One good and one not so good by-election result last week. A lot of talk about the leadership and what Labour does now. What do you think the party has to do to try to improve these poll ratings?
I am now sat on the shadow cabinet, and around me are a lot of really good people. The problem that we've got is, all that the media sees, because all the media focuses on, is Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy is a great man, but he's just one person in a whole team. And what we're doing is, we're trying to bring forward policies which actually look at how Labour can respond to today. We have a great history, that's fabulous, I celebrate all of that, but it's how can we be most effective to address things like equality, about poverty, about what we do with the NHS. And we're working on all of those things. And I know it sounds really tame, but we just need a bit of time to be able to get them to the table and then let people judge all of us and judge Labour, because we've got some fantastic people that are really passionate about this. We just need a little bit of settling time.
And do you think that's why Copeland didn't go so well?
I think the problem with Copeland is people were getting very mixed messages. I have to say the Tories did a fantastic campaign in saying that Labour wasn't supportive of nuclear. That's nonsense. We do support it. It's in our manifesto that we support it. So it's kind to trying to find a way, and it's doing podcasts like this, to cut across what the sort of the mainstream media is saying and actually talk to people and tell them the truth about what we stand for. So that's what we need to be doing much more of.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to all my guests this week. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.